You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here is your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I'm Dr. Allison Marshall.
And I'm Dr. John Langlois.
And you are listening to the special monthly Chi University episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for January 28. Good morning, Horse World.
Good morning.
Welcome to our once-a-month look at traditional Chinese veterinary medicine with the Chi University.
So, John, we've got another colleague to talk with us today about anhidrosis. Our fabulous teaching colleague, Dr. Kaylee Seitz, is going to be with us, joining us from Ocala.
Yeah, I'm really excited because he's reasonably new to the area, and he's built up a wonderful practice, and that speaks of his abilities to do, and certainly enjoy him as a colleague in training at the Chi, and it's been a wonderful experience. And I said he's moved from teaching the mixed animal groups to the equine groups, and he's always reliable and always prepared. So I'm expecting it's going to be a great chat.
I love his demeanor. He seems to be incredibly thorough and, you know, one of those people who's very quietly brilliant. So I'm sure he'll have a lot to tell us today about anhidrosis.
I look forward to it.
So we are so lucky, John and I, today to have Dr. Kaylee Seitz on our podcast. Dr. Seitz is one of our co-teachers at Chi University, and he has got a practice in Ocala, and he does great things in Ocala and is a very, very busy practitioner. So Dr. Seitz, welcome, Dr. Kaylee.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Welcome.
We're super happy to have you. And my understanding is you're here to talk. Well, first of all, this is your busy season, right? Like, I'm sitting up here in the snow in Virginia, and you guys are pretty busy down there with all of the horse show and stuff, right? This is your.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Certainly. January through April is a super busy time of year. And I feel like every year it's starting a little bit earlier. So honestly, I feel like this year it began in the beginning of December, you know, because World Equestrian Center here at Ocala, which is a pretty amazing venue, as well as HITS. Yeah, they're just having more and more shows just start earlier and people are kind of coming down before the holidays. So yeah, it ends up being a pretty long but very busy show season. It's great though. I really love it, staying really busy and, you know, just seeing all the really high performance horses. It's really fun to see them and get to work on them.
That's super cool. And so anhidrosis is one of those things that you deal with quite a bit being down in Florida. I've had my practice in Virginia in 20 years, and it's only been in about the last 5 years that I've really treated a couple cases a summer for anhidrosis. And I know from all the other teachers at Chi that you guys see that a whole lot down in North Florida.
Yes, it is. It's really not a concern or an issue this time of year, but as it warms up and certainly through those hot, humid summer months, it's a very big problem. The prevalence as a whole is, this really applies to Florida, but in a study a couple of years ago, about 11.2% of the farms that were surveyed had at least one horse with anhidrosis.
Wow.
And as a whole, 1.8% of horses as a whole in Florida. And that does not include like racetrack farms. So it's a lot more sport horse, I guess, and, you know, just personal horses.
So yeah, and I think we mentioned during one teaching session that July, August, maybe a little bit September, it seems like 3 out of 5 phone calls are sweating related issues when we're in the middle of it. So it's a lot of cases.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I end up getting so many calls and appointments for it. in the summertime here, especially the late summer, particularly where it almost gets a little mind-numbing and your day gets truly a little bit repetitive, because I've had days where I treat 7 to 10 anhidrosis horses a day.
Yeah. Holy cow. That's a ton.
Yeah.
That's mind-boggling.
It seems to be increasing over the years. You know, I've been doing it 40-something years, and it just seems like it's more and more and more. And I'm glad and excited that we can talk about, you know, what TCVM could possibly offer, other than, again, what Western medicine typically does for it. And maybe we can get into that, maybe how, when you get a phone call, you know, a lot of times people have already tried a lot of things to help. And, you know, they may say, well, you know, I put them on that 1AC, I put them on beer, I put them on electrolytes, and I put them on all these things, and I'm still not seeing the horse sweat. So how do you approach that?
Yeah, so my personal take on those, and I get a lot of the same things where it's sort of like, well, we've tried everything else, and, you know, you're kind of our last stop sometimes. I personally don't think that any of the supplements are detrimental. You know, there's a lot out there. I'd say 1AC and beer are among the most common. Other things I've heard are vodka. There's like a Platinum Refresh product, Mega Sweat, quite a few of them. And I personally, you know, I've seen some people where they're like, well, this supplement worked like magic for my one horse, but then it didn't do anything for another horse. And that's kind of been my experience with a lot of these therapies, is just that, you know, the supplements in particular will really be amazing for one horse, and then they just don't seem to do anything for the next 50. And I medically cannot explain to you why that is. So I don't think that there's anything wrong with trying them. I think it's just important that people give them a fair trial period. And if you don't see improvement, I would probably, you know, not continue to spend your money on it. Again, it's not that it's detrimental to the horse, but if you're burning a hole in your pocketbook, you know, I don't, if you're not getting a response after like 30 days, 45 at most, I'd probably switch it up and try something else. And whether it's, you know, another supplement if need be, or acupuncture.
Right. And when you're working on these animals, sometimes you just, I say, listen, if you want to stay with what you're doing, and then we'll go ahead and approach it from TCVM, that's fine. If you want to take them off, that's fine. But I do agree with your comment that many times they have found that it worked on a horse in the past, and this time it's not working. And again, I don't have an answer for why. It's an individual thing, but that's when we can offer our help. And yeah, so with a specific case or so, you would just kind of go into what would you do in the way of evaluation. And, you know, diagnosing non-sweaters is a pretty easy thing, right? I mean, their respiration rate's up, no sweat, and they're working, and case closed, correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, certainly most of the horses, I would say I don't get a phone call until people really notice a decrease in the sweating. But then it's also often their respiratory rate and just time they take to cool out after the work, you know, seems excessively long, and they really have that nasal flare and they're blowing. You will get sometimes people will catch it really early when they're just starting to notice that respiratory rate be abnormally increased. But often it's a little bit later in the game, because initially sometimes it can be subtle. My experience has been that it's usually pretty quite clear. There certainly are Western medical ways of officially diagnosing it, where they either inject different concentrations of epinephrine or butylene under the skin. But, you know, I guess my feeling on that, that's a bit academic. You have to ultimately look at the patient's overall clinical picture. And, you know, it's kind of often a presumptive diagnosis. Yeah. So one of the first things, I guess, that I will ask and do on the exam when I'm assessing a horse with anhidrosis or suspected anhidrosis is one, to just look at their overall clinical picture, as well as ask how long has it been going on? Because I do think that acute versus chronic anhidrosis are quite different. The acute anhidrosis, where they've just kind of recently stopped, they've never necessarily had it, haven't had it in prior summers, often respond quicker and faster and better than those horses with chronic anhidrosis. You know, if they've been going on with this for years, we know that microscopically those sweat cells actually atrophy and and become completely unreceptive. So I think physically, it's questionable to whether those cells can even ever go back to normal to producing sweat. So the chronic ones are definitely a bit tougher to treat than the acute ones. And then I just also just look at the horse. I mean, I look at their respiratory rate. One of the biggest things, I do this with all of my exams down here during the summer, especially, is I just put my hand, as I'm putting my hands on them, whether I'm scanning them for the diagnostic acupuncture scan or palpating a sore spot or something, I always run my hand like under their mane and between their hind legs to feel if I appreciate some sweat, because honestly, most horses, even if you're standing in the shade down here, probably should be a little sweaty under their mane or tail during those hot, humid summer months here in Florida. So, you know, it's always a bit on my radar, and I always ask the owner, are they working okay? Are they maybe like getting tired too fast? Something, you know, sometimes I'll try and cue into some things that might maybe give us an early warning sign of it, so we can try and be a little more proactive about it. But those are some of just the simple things that I start with when I get a call about a horse with anhidrosis.
Do you find that when you have a client that comes to you and says, yeah, he's sweating, but he's just not sweating enough. You know, he's breathing up too much and he should be sweating more for what we're doing. Do you find in your experience that treating those cases that are partial sweaters, they respond better than those that have completely shut down and don't sweat at all?
Yeah, for sure. I'm certainly much more optimistic, not necessarily at getting a response at all, but as particularly with getting, you know, a quick response, I'm usually optimistic that I'll get a response within a couple treatments, maybe even just one, for those that are still partial sweaters. For the ones that are completely shut down, if you're in the middle of the summer, I'm a bit more guarded about getting them sweating to a significant degree that summer. You know, a lot of times we're trying to help them as best that we can. And I have had quite a few horses where they get that year, if they're completely shut down, they'll get better with the therapy, but they won't quite get back to normal. But maybe we can improve them good enough to stay in work and keep doing their job. I think kind of come back to this a little bit later, but I think probably the single most important thing, especially for those ones that have a history of anhidrosis, is treating them early in the spring or just before it starts to get really warm. When we're trying to catch in these guys and they're already in the middle of the summer and they're shut down, you know, we're way behind on the curve. Like that's a reactive therapy. We're just, you know, getting there once the problem already exists. If you can get them, start treating them and try and maintain that balance with the acupuncture early in the spring. So here I would usually tell people, like, often Marchish, we probably need to do a couple treatments, and often in the spring, even if I wasn't able to get them to sweat at all the prior summer, I've had quite a few of those horses that when I come back to them in the spring and treat them, often I do one, two, maybe three treatments and 6-ish weeks of the herbal therapy. And they're like, great, for the rest of the year. So I do think the time of year that you're treating them, what the current environmental conditions are like, sure, that absolutely makes a big difference in the horse's response.
And when
I love hearing.
Yeah, go ahead.
I love hearing everything that you're saying, because that is exactly what I have found too, is that the ones that have been chronic are just, I can't see, I can make some headway the first year, but the second year is helpful. And I find the same thing, that there is one herbal formula, as you guys know, for non-sweaters. And I do find that's helpful. And I've had a couple over the years that I've just put on the herbs and they've been fine. But I tell my clients all the time that the less chronic something is, the easier it is to fix with any medicine. So something that's been going on, I don't care what it is, especially if it's something internal, and non-sweating is certainly an internal metabolic enigma, you know, for all of us. And it does just take a while. So I'm actually quite relieved, because the trajectory that you just explained is exactly what I experience. And I don't have nearly the caseload of this that you do.
And, you know, when you look at our teachings, you know, all three of us have been studied under Dr. Shea, and he oftentimes, in any case, asks his students, he says, what do you feel like the prognosis is in this case? He said, he looks at their eyes, he looks at their overall things. He said, are you positive about this? So in cases where you're dealing with anhidrosis, do you try to stay away from prognosis and expectations, or do you just explain like, okay, listen, we're going to try three treatments. We're going to go 30 days on the herbs and then we'll reevaluate? Or how do you approach it in the way when they're wanting to know what the expectations or prognosis is?
Well, I guess I do a little bit of both. I think it's very important with acupuncture to set up reasonable expectations and give reasonable prognoses, because personally, I think I've found that the most common reason I see somebody say that they feel acupuncture doesn't work is because they had a horse in the past that had maybe a chronic or difficult problem. Maybe nobody else could figure it out. And they tried acupuncture one time, they get one treatment and it didn't respond. And it's like, well, you know, it's not magic. And while sometimes we do get really dramatic rapid improvement, even after just one treatment, I really want people to understand, you know, you got to give me a few
fair shake
if they're not responding. Yeah. So yeah, that's what, you know, if we're in that middle of the summer and the horse is completely shut down, I'm like, I will pretty much right away say, you know, this is going to be a little bit more difficult to get turned around. I really need you to give me some time. Give me, you know, a few treatments. I would usually say at least three, if not four treatments, anywhere from, I typically do them 1 to 2 weeks apart, depending on the horse's overall clinical picture. Cause I've had some that were not sweating, but they were still comfortable, you know, in managing the heat. Okay. And then I've had some horses that just look miserable. And I'm like, so the ones that are pretty bad, I don't like their clinical picture and the horse looks really stressed, I'm much more inclined to treat them aggressively, you know, once a week. Honestly, I think you could do twice a week. I'm generally, you know, going somewhere between 1 and 2 weeks apart for treatment. And then if we do start to get a response, once we have a solid, consistent response, sure, then I'll back off some, maybe go to every 3 or 4 weeks until we get out of the hot season. So I think it's really important to discuss, you know, and say, I'm a little guarded about this one, that we expect a slower response from it, because I don't want people to give up too quickly, because it's not always that simple.
So if you have a case where, you know, maybe this is more pertinent in a backyard ownership situation, where you come and, you know, maybe finances are limited and you say, well, I'm going to do some acupuncture, but I really want you to consider doing the herbal on top, because as we understand from Dr. Shea's teaching, the acupuncture begins the healing process and the herbal finishes it. So what would you say if they said, well, I can't do both for whatever reason? How would you approach that?
Yeah, if they can't do both, I guess my inclination would probably be to do the herbal therapy because I feel it's, you know, it's going to address, from a Chinese medical perspective, it's addressing the problem on a deeper level of pathology than, you know, than the acupuncture is. But it's also, as Dr. Shea would say, it's also like a little bit of acupuncture every day. So I guess as long as the horse, we don't have any palatability concerns, the horse isn't super picky or something, I probably would be inclined to do that, because I think that, yeah, I guess I suspect that will probably be the most bang for the buck.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's kind of the way I approach it, too. And just also sharing, you know, back on that prognosis thing or expectations, I remember several years ago, I had two cases of 2-year-olds that were breathing up 80 times a minute, could only be trained at 4 or 4:30 in the morning because of the heat. Geez. And I treated them 3 times with no change. I invited Dr. Shea to come over and he treated them several times. And we never changed these horses. And
wow.
I share this because, you know, we have to also say sometimes when things don't go what we expect. And a young 2-year-old that's got acute shutdown, 2 of them, I gave it a good prognosis and it didn't, we didn't help those horses. And I asked Dr. Shea, I said, well, you know, why didn't he? He said, well, there's some genetic component. And I said, I don't understand what that means, but, you know, this may be the case where you say, if you have another training operation a little bit further up north, maybe that's our ticket if we can't get them going.
Well, and I think environment, period, is just a big deal. You know what I mean? I think that food plays a big role, but you know, you kind of think about the fjord ponies and the Northern European, well, warm bloods certainly fall into that category, and they're asked to be in Florida heat or South, you know, Southern America heat. They're just not built for that. So that makes a lot of sense. Maybe though, even though they were thoroughbreds, maybe they were Irish thoroughbreds. Do you know what I mean? Or yeah, it makes a lot of sense that there are just some things that can't be overcome.
And whether some of the studies that have done, they really haven't shown a breed predilection, you know, or an age predilection. It just seems to, you know, show up. And from the flip side of the coin, when I mentioned those two cases that didn't respond, I've had horses start sweating while I'm treating them. So, So it's like we don't really know, but we can give them those expectations based on something acute, something young, something strong. Those should respond pretty well.
Well, and you think about a lot of those horses that have what Chinese medicine would call internal heat. They're not dissipating their heat well. So it might not be that they have anhidrosis, but they end up with respiratory problems, or they end up with skin problems or something like that. So
yes, and good point, because we do see that. In fact, that's one of these early telltale signs. You'll see that little bit of loss of hair on the face and maybe just a little bit on the chest or shoulder. The skin looks a little drier than usual, and that's your kind of like your almost your early start to heading off into not sweating at all.
And going back to Dr. Lingua's point about or comment about Dr. Shea saying that there's a genetic component, that's absolutely right. The research really hasn't identified any age, sex, or even color predisposition. Although I'll be honest, I realize it's not scientific; it's anecdotal, but I've definitely seen dark horses, dark bays, browns, and blacks are what I think are the most common. And I mean, that's just simple physics. They're attracting a lot more heat than lighter colored horses. So that puts even that much more strain on the cooling system of their body. But going to the genetics, when they've looked at, been trying to explain risk factors or identify risk factors for anhidrosis, the single biggest risk factor of a horse with anhidrosis is having another closely related horse with anhidrosis in its family. So it actually, if a given horse has a closely related horse in its family, it is 21.7 times more likely to develop anhidrosis.
Genetic. I knew that was more likely, but way to haul out the numbers, Kaylee.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's pretty significant. So certainly, I don't think it's as simple as genetics. I think it's unquestionably multifactorial, but there does seem to be certainly a strong genetic predisposition for given horses.
Yeah, and I'll agree with your comment about the dark horse. And, you know, just in general, going back, that's where you'll see it most prevalent, in the dark bays and browns.
Yeah,
and blacks.
Yeah. I can't think of any grays that I've ever treated, honestly.
Mm.
I think I've had a couple.
Yeah.
And trust me, when I walked up to them, you know, not knowing that if it was the first time I've seen them, I was like, oh, it's a gray. don't see it. Yeah, I just don't see it very often.
So fascinating.
So, for me down here in Florida, I focus a lot on performance horses, really mostly sport horses, the hunter jumpers. I do some race horses, but just lots of performance sport horses, English sport horses mostly. And I think it's, you know, this is really a big problem for them, because it can be not only significantly performance limiting, but I mean, in the most severe cases, anhidrosis can even be fatal. Absolutely. I haven't seen that, but, you know, especially for me, where I'm trying to help, you know, maybe some Grand Prix horses or something, everybody, you know, stay cool and perform at their best. You know, it really is a pretty big issue in performance limiting, both for the sport horses and the race horses down here. So yeah, it's a very big issue.
Go ahead.
You first.
Going back on, you know, you mentioned, and I think it's a great comment about let's not put the fire out in the middle of the summer. Let's work on the animal in the spring. And I have seen some practitioners go ahead, and we all know that the Nujan Rusan is our herb for when the summer heat toxin is present. But in the spring, oftentimes, and it's been somewhat that I have to discuss with my client and say, well, you put this other horse on the Nujan Rusan and help. Why are you doing this different in the spring? And I say, well, what we're doing is we're balancing what the animal is experiencing now. So I will choose other herbs. Let's say it's a little bit yin deficient, or meaning it just doesn't have enough air conditioning, but it's still sweating. Well, then I'm going to go ahead and treat that. So I treat for what the pattern is in the spring, and it may be entirely different than my approach when they actually are breathing up 60, 70, 80 times a minute.
Yeah. Because I think certainly, you know, there's some horses that may not have any other systemic disease or other, you know, dramatically different Chinese medical pattern diagnoses when you're looking at them, but some do. So I think, you know, it kind of, as we've all been taught, you gotta treat what you see at that time in Chinese medicine. I do think, you know, sometimes it's a little tricky treating some of them with metabolic disease, like Cushing's disease, because that tends to be a yin deficient pattern. And so sometimes you're managing multiple things. And yeah, exactly. I think you got to still make sure you carefully examine the horse every time and treat what you see that day.
I've seen a lot of concurrent Cushing's disease with anhidrosis. Not that I've seen a lot of anhidrosis, but I definitely find that it seems almost that what we would say internal heat in Chinese medicine, when most cases of Cushing's disease is like a broken air conditioner. So it already starts them not being cooled off, but I definitely have treated that concurrently. And I do have a case that I've talked about on a different podcast of a fjord pony that is in my practice that had insulin resistance, And I was asked to treat non-sweaters, but I threw in some needles each time for insulin resistance. And during the first, 6 months of her treatment, her insulin came back down to normal. So I do think it's super important if there is an underlying disease process that may have set off the anhydrosis. You know, the philosophy in Chinese medicine is that John, and you guys can help me with this, but the body gets confused, like with the heat and humidity. That's the Chinese philosophy anyway, that the body gets confused because the air is wet and then just shuts the sweat down. Is that my rudimentary understanding?
Yeah. I think that's right. And, there's, again, non-sweating, both in human medicine and in veterinary medicine, is still a little bit of a mystery. And I think that what has been proposed is that we're just getting an overstimulation because of the heat and humidity of the sweat glands, and the receptors that are associated with them are no longer responding any longer. So that's kind of like the shutdown, that we're not getting the connection of the adrenergic receptors when that happens. So that's one way that I look at it, that there is perhaps a, biochemical reason for that happening. And I think it's all precipitated from the humidity and the heat. And I have to mention that I have several colleagues in California, and they said that we never see a case of that out here.
Because it's dry.
Dry.
Yep. It does make sense that there's an underlying metabolic thing, that the body's already out of balance and gets confused.
Well, if you have all that humidity around the skin,
absolutely.
Why does it want to sweat when it's already got all that moisture?
Right. Yeah.
But they've kind of, as far from a Western medical perspective, they've proposed many different causes, and that's the tough thing. Is about anhydrosis is from a Western medical perspective, we really don't have a specific understanding of the pathology and the signaling, the changes in the signaling that are occurring or shutting down or not occurring for that matter. So without that understanding, you can't really even offer a therapy.
And sure.
Where Chinese medicine is great, and I tell people that all the time, it may seem weird. It's weird to get out of our usual way of thinking about things, but Chinese medicine provides us an entirely different way of looking at a problem and therefore an entirely different way of treating it. And maybe that's why it's such a good option. It's a whole sort of paradigm shift in how we're even thinking about it. And that's why I like to go to it as an option. From the Western medical perspective, they've offered so many different theories that it was like related to hypothyroidism, which is like super uncommon. True hypothyroidism is super uncommon in horses. They also think, that there could be abnormally increased epinephrine production or decreased chloride levels. I realize we're getting a little detailed here, but there's a type of antibiotic called macrolide antibiotics that are often used to treat rhodococcus infection in foals. And part of the way it works is it interferes with chloride transport across cell membranes. And they've noticed that macrolide antibiotics can cause, I'm not going to say anhydrosis, but it can stop their sweating while they're on. And so that really has led researchers to think that it does have something to do with chloride transport across cell membranes. But it still is exactly what Dr. Langlois was just describing, that, if it's always hot out and your body's always telling your sweat glands, we got to sweat. At some point you just exhaust, it's like somebody ringing a bell for help constantly. At some point you just can't keep it up anymore and they shut down. They stop, they stop their sensitivity. It's like if somebody, poked you in the back constantly, it's going to be really annoying and you're going to respond to it first. But after a while, if it truly just keeps up, you just stop responding. And that's what the sweat glands do.
And more like impetus to treat things early. You know what I mean? The earliest we can get on top of things. And I know we say that a lot in this podcast in general, but acupuncture can treat so many things that Western medicine doesn't have an answer for. But just like you guys said, it takes multiple treatments and it takes not waiting until the animals had the problem for 5 years, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm finding that a lot of the conventional medicine practitioners, at least in our area, they're warming up to the idea that oftentimes they don't have a solution. So they are asking their clients to reach out to a trained TCVM practitioner to put that in the mix.
Yeah, I certainly get some kind of traditional equine practitioners that routinely refer cases to me. Yeah, because they just don't have anything else to offer. And certainly, you know, I always discuss with owners, you know, that the Chinese medical approach to anhidrosis, it's not perfect. I think they generally report about a 60 to 70% success rate, but I think that's dramatically higher than the supplements. So it's certainly not perfect, but I do think it's a lot more reliable than a lot of the other modalities. And I will say, like, you know, when they've done a lot of research on a lot of these supplements and basically, you know, have found that none of them pass any degree of scientific evaluation that they're actually effective. Yeah. So it's very spotty. I'm not going to say they don't work, but often when they do work, it just seems to be real hit or miss.
Yeah, and I think if you look on the other side of that, that there has been some studies done in children using Zhongrusan, which is part of the new Zhongrusan that we use. And they found that there was some 93% just with the herbal improvement in symptoms with children that had sweating issues. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. So that herb is really, really very special for assisting in getting an animal to sweat.
And have we discussed, like, from a Chinese medical perspective, aside from just the body being a bit confused, that sort of the mechanism by which anhidrosis would occur? I guess I have, like, a little bit of a story, but an analogy that I tell my clients that
I want to hear it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what I end up telling everybody are, the TCVM thought, Chinese medical mentality on how anhidrosis occurs is, you know, we always talk about that Chinese medicine is all about balance, that health comes from balance. There's not really like good and bad things. It's just that they need to be balanced out within your body. And with anhidrosis, we're particularly concerned with yin and yang energy, with yin energy kind of being like the AC system of the house. It's like the cooling, it provides nourishing fluids. It's kind of the cold or dark side of the energy that's also nourishing. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, that there's yang energy, which contains some qi, but it's heating, it's very warming. There's lots of yang sort of energy down here in Florida. It's always very hot in the environment. And so the other kind of unusual thing is that in Chinese medicine, there's pathogens that in the Western world, would seem very unusual to us, but this is the way we think about things in Chinese medicine. So things like wind and damp and cold and heat can all be external pathogens, things outside of the body that can invade the body and cause problems and cause imbalance. And so because there's so much yang energy, which we would really call summer heat, which is like a severe heat and damp together, so hot and humid, basically. And it's like puts a constant stressor on the yin in the body, because The yin is the AC system, and if the body is the house, the AC system has to keep the body cool and keep that heat out of the house. And if it's always hot and the AC system is always running, it's too much workload on the AC and it burns out. And then that external heat from the outside environment can get into the body. And I think of that external heat is in yin deficiency is boiling off some of the bodily fluids if it's chronic enough. And things dry up a bit, you get, you know, blood deficient and yin deficient, and they stop sweating. And that heat, that summer heat from the environment is circulating in the blood. And I always mention that because I think a very important part of acupuncture for anhidrosis involves using hemoacupuncture, which is a different type of acupuncture that maybe a lot of people haven't seen and sometimes could make people a little anxious because it's different. But the treatment for acupuncture often involves some hemoacupuncture where we're actually letting out some blood. And the idea there is that we're trying to, since that heat is in the body is in the blood, we're trying to let some of that excess heat out while at the same time tonifying the yin to get the AC system running in the house again. We want to get a nice wind, if you will, like opening a window and letting a nice breeze come through to push some of that heat trapped in the house out. So that's the hemoacupuncture part. And then the last thing is usually trying to help open the pores of the skin. So those are usually kind of your three main therapeutic objectives when we're treating it. But that's sort of the philosophy or the mindset that we're thinking about this problem and why we're doing what we're doing.
And to take it even a little bit further is we understand from traditional Chinese veterinary medicine that there's two, maybe three organs in the body that are responsible for maintaining perspiration. And the heart is one of them. I mean, it controls perspiration and it propels the flow of blood and it moves body fluid. And the lung, as we know, opens up the surface and it also controls the immune function on the surface so that as we understand this pathogen, summer heat pathogen, it's got to get access somewhere. But if your defense mechanism is strong, then it won't get into the body as easily. So we really function in our approach of acupuncture to tonify or enhance the function of the lung or the surface, enhance the function of the heart to make more blood, to make more fluids, and to be able to have plenty of ability to perspire.
Yep, absolutely. And yeah, I do, as I mentioned, I do kind of always mention that particularly to help people understand the hemoacupuncture part of it, because sometimes that stresses people out a little bit, but it's actually quite mild and the horses really tolerate it great.
And, you know, we have sometimes where we bleed the ear and we bleed the tongue and we bleed up on the forearm. And it's funny because I have to mention to my holders and my clients that if we bleed the tongue and we bleed the ear, that horse is going to shake his head and you're going to be wearing it. So we have to be aware that that's going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome. One last thing before we part, I wanted to mention that in Chinese medicine food therapy, which I love to deal with, watermelon, and in particularly watermelon rind, is something that I will often recommend that my clients feed their horses. And I've had varying responses to the horses eating that. I don't know what you two have had response wise. And because I'm treating the rest of the horse, I can't say that those watermelon eaters do so much better than the non-watermelon eaters. And Dr. Shea has said if the horse doesn't eat the rind, then leave a little bit of the pink on and kind of blend it up in a food processor and all that sort of thing. Do you guys have any? It's something to try to make them better. Do you guys have any comments on how you've seen response to that?
Well, I'll make a one pot and I'll put in the celery, cucumber, and the rind, and I'll find out Ooh. Which one they like, and then I'll let them eat it.
Perfect.
I was going to say, I generally always do throw that in there. The food therapy component is an option. And yes, I do typically recommend the watermelon rind, ideally with no pink part, like the part that we would eat. But if you do have a picky eater, yeah, you might have to leave a little bit of the pink. That I think the big important thing there is that the pink part of the watermelon can have quite a bit of sugar. So if you do have metabolic disease, horse with metabolic disease, it's important they not get a lot of that, because that could cause other problems. But yes, I also, the watermelon rind cut up into cubes as little treats, or the cucumber. I hadn't heard of the celery, so I will add that one in. Any food with cold energies to them should be beneficial.
Yeah, and we could even take that a little further and just say, okay, if you're, you know, what are you feeding your animal? And if it's on, you know, a strong oat diet, which are very warming, maybe we can make recommendations. Let's put it on something a little cooling. Not maybe it's going to change the anhidrosis, but it's certainly going to change the comfort of the animal if it's not so hot.
Yeah. Well, and my understanding is that celery is liver cooling. So for those horses with Cushing's disease, that might be a great double whammy to cool off the liver dominated. Often Cushing's disease is effective in the liver from the Chinese perspective. But the other thing that I wonder about is aloe vera. You know, we're taught that watermelon and aloe vera are the two coldest things out there, but I've always limited my aloe vera use to stomach ulcers. I don't know if you guys have any comments about that.
Well, it's generally cooling, so I don't see any downside to that.
Right.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, that was another one that, yeah, was not on my list, but that's quite readily available. So I think that that's a very easy thing to try.
And y'all's dosage would be an ounce once or twice a day of aloe vera juice bought over in the CVS and the pharmacy of any Walmart, whatever.
Yeah, I encourage them to get just straight aloe of a high quality.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't get aloe with six or seven other things in it.
Right.
And staying on the food therapy perspective of this, and I mean, Dr. Langlois just mentioned this, but as a whole, if you have a horse with anhidrosis and they're on a relatively high carbohydrate diet, like a sweet feed or just something, do you guys, I mean, I know carbohydrates are very warming. So I have told people that, yes, I do think that trying to switch them to a lower starch diet will be
beneficial.
It's not going to be detrimental, but
it
probably will help some. How important do you guys think that is in the overall therapy for this?
Because I think food therapy is important. I feel like it would be really important. I'm reviewing my anhidrosis cases, which as I've mentioned, are few, and they all seem to be fat ponies that are already not eating carbs, or older, you know, older horses, upper teens or whatever, and they're not eating carbs at that point either. John?
Well, I like I said, I don't know how much we're affecting the disease process, which causes the anhidrosis. But in general, if you have a hot animal, feed it a cooling food. It's just a basic principle.
Right.
Yeah. Always strive towards balance.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That's amazing, Kaylee. Thanks for all that information. Wow, that was one of our best podcasts, I think. Certainly most thorough covering of a subject of anhidrosis. It was so great to have Dr. Kaylee on.
Yeah, and as we mentioned earlier, I thought it was going to be a great discussion, and it was wonderful. And it's such an important topic to cover in the area of Florida, and of course in many areas of the country. So he did a super job, and I thank him for that.
Yes, I second that, and I thank him for that as well. If anybody in the Ocala area would like to contact Dr. Kaylee Seitz, I can tell you that he is busy, 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 and I can't think of a funniest thing to say about busy. He's busy, but he has Blue Oak Veterinary Bodywork, which you can find at blueoakveterinary.com and investigate whether or not he can come and see your horse, because he does like chiropractic, veterinary spinal manipulation, whatever you want to call that, veterinary medical manipulation. So he does body work, he does acupuncture and Chinese herbal medicine. So look him up. If anybody needs to contact John or I, you can contact us through CHIU.edu, which is Qi University. If you have any questions about Qi University in general, or if you'd like to find a practitioner in your area of Montana or St. Louis or Texas or whatever, then if you go to CHIU.edu and you scroll down, it will have a button that says find a practitioner. And if you follow through that, it will ask you for your zip code. And it has a bunch of codes as to how different people have been trained through Qi, whether it's acupuncture or herbs or everything. But you can help find a practitioner to practice Chinese medicine in your area.
Very good. And it's under the resource section. So go there and find a practitioner. And
perfect.
Yeah, that works really well.
And thank you for another podcast, John. I have my quote of the day.
I am ready.
Okay. This is from Henry Ford. Obstacles are those frightful things you see when you take your eyes off your goal.